begin. And then, of course, we don't have a shiur the next two Tuesday nights due to Yantif. And then we'll resume, God willing, after Sukkot, whatever that is. I think it's October 5th. We are at the start of the fifth perek. The Plishtim have taken the Aron. The Plishtim are going to regret having taken the Aron. And it's a very simple perek in terms of structure. Basically, first of all, it's only 12 psukim. You only have 12 sentences in the whole thing. So the first, you know, Aleph to Ches, 1 to 8, are the Aron in the city of Ashdod. And then the latter four psukim, the Aron in Gat and Ekron. Remember, the Plishtim have what's called a Pentapolis. They had five cities, which were individually governed, and then they had some kind of a setup for the governors of the five, the Sarnei Plishtim, to work together. So their cities, we're going to see three of them, Ashdod, Gat, and Ekron, the other ones being Aza and Ashkelon. So we're going to need to understand why the Plishtim do what they do with the Aron, and why Hashem does what he does to the Plishtim. Those are both questions that we're going to need to address. So let's start out by looking briefly at the first part of the Perek. So again, it's Perek Hey, chapter 5, Pasuk Aleph, and we'll look at the first eight psukim with a little bit of explanation along the way, and then we'll really have to understand what it was that happened here. So I'm just flipping a couple of pages. Okay. Uflishtim lakhu es aron ha'elokim. As we know, the Plishtim took the Aron. This is really sort of recap sentence, because we knew in chapter 4 they took the Aron, but then we digress to talk about what happened with Eli, and what happened with Chafni and Pinchas, and what happened with Pinchas's widow giving birth. So we recap and say the Plishtim had taken the Aron of God, Vayaviyuhu me'evan ha'ezer Ashdoda. And they took it to Ashdod. And what do they do in Ashdod? Vayikhu plishtim es aron ha'elokim vayaviyu aso beis dagon. They took that aron that they had captured. It's almost as though the first lakhu is captured, and the second chu is took. They took the aron that they had captured, vayaviyu aso beis dagon, and they brought it to the house of Dagon. Vayatzigu oso etzal dagon. Vayatzigu, do you know that word? Vayatzigu? There's a modern Hebrew word that comes from here. You familiar with the word hatzaga? A hatzaga is a play or a performance, right? Vayatzigu, they put it out there on display next to dagon. So it will become very clear momentarily that Dagon is some kind of deity, and there's only some question as to what kind of deity this is. What Hebrew words do you know that are similar to Dagon?
Dagon, wheat.
Right, Dagon is wheat. So yes. And the other one is fish, right? We're going to read Yonah. So theoretically, you could say it's a grain deity, like Baal is, but then really it should be Baal or Baal Dagon. Like, Baal was pretty dominant in the region as the god of grain, among other things. So Rashi takes the view that Chuck mentions, which is that it's a fish god. If you take a look at Rashi, the top source on the sheet, Dagon, Dimus Asui Kidimus Dag. It was a form like a fish. It was some kind of a fish figure, which makes sense, because remember where the Plishtim came from. The Plishtim are sea people. They make their way to the area from the Aegean Sea area up by Greece and Turkey and that area. When exactly they came, that's a great discussion for another time. But it's a fish god. That's the way Rashi believes. The problem with saying it's a fish god is what's coming in the next couple of sentences. Take a look. Pasuk Gimel. Vayashkimu Ashdodim mimacharas. The people of Ashdod get up the next morning. Vihine Dagon nofel lefanav arza. And Dagon is on the ground in front of the Aron, lefnei Aron Hashem. Vayikhu es Dagon, Vayashivu es Olim Kamal, and they put Dagon back where it belonged. Vayashkimu vabokem imacharas, and they get up the next morning. Vihinei Dagon nofel afanav artzalif ne'aron Hashem, and again, it's on the ground, in front of the Aron. Virosh Dagon ushte kapos yadav, krusos el hamiftan, rak Dagon nishar alav. The head of Dagon and the two hands of Dagon are cut off on the threshold. Only the body of Dagon remains. So now you have to ask yourself a question. How many fish do you know that have hands? If it's the form of a fish, as Rashi says, where did this fish get hands? So Radak does the logical thing. Take a look at source number 2. He says it's a merman. Amru, they said, ki Dagon mi tiburo ulamata hayatsuras dag. From the navel down, Dagon was in the form of a fish. Lefichach nikra Dagon, that's why it's called Dagon. Umi tiburo ulamala, from the navel and up, tsuras adam, the form of a human being. Kemoshama ushte kapos yadav, kusos alam iftan, like this thing about the two hands. Vizeu perusha, rak Dagon nishar alav, and when the text says only Dagon remained on it, that means the fish part. Tsuras dag nishar alav. Yeah, the form of a fish remaining, but the humanoid part is missing. And then just to round it out, Ralbag says, I don't know what you're talking about. The whole thing was a human form. Don't get confused by the word Dagon. So this is some kind of a god. Grain god, possibly, more likely fish god, as the Mefarshim take it. Whether it was fully in the form of a fish or not, clearly not fully, or it wouldn't have hands. It's got some kind of a hybrid form or a human form, unclear, but the real import of these lines, of course, is not whether Dagon looks like a fish or not. It's night after night, something is happening. The Aron is doing something to Dagon. First it gets knocked over, then it gets knocked over and it loses its hands. Yes, Chuck? You're muted. You're talking. Oh, you have that Eitzel. I see. So I'm going to talk about shortly, or in a little bit anyway, why the Plishtim put the Aron there. And there are a couple of different possibilities that may bias the way I look at the word Eitzel. If I just said the word Eitzel, I would say it's next to, because that's the way we usually use the word Eitzel. But we're going to need to ask the question of what the Plishtim thought they were doing when they took the Aron, and that, again, that may influence the way we look at the word Eitzel. What were you going to suggest?
Confusion. Because, or an aggrandizement of the mirror. Because the translation says Eitzel. So if it fell, the idol Dagon fell, not fall in front of the Aron, it would fall beside the Aron.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was opposite, then it would make sense for it to fall in front of the Aron.
Well, I'm not sure I accept that premise, because the whole thing is miraculous. In other words, the whole concept that the Aron is somehow causing Dagon to fall is already an intervention. So even if Dagon was actually next to the Aron was next to Dagon, it could still fall and roll in front of the Aron. The whole thing is a miracle.
I agree, but it's more of a miracle.
Okay.
If they're next to each other as opposed to
close to one another. I mean, that just means it's more of a message to the Plishtim. Whatever message God is sending, and God is sending the message to, is getting more of an impact. Well, let's see what happens. The Plishtim have to realize something is wrong at this point. So, look at Pasuk Hey. We throw in this very odd sentence that we're going to have to come back to. Al Kain, because of this, Lo Yidrachu Chohanei Dagon, V'chol Aboim Beis Dagon, Al Miftan Dagon Be'ashdod, Ad Hayom Hazeh. To this very day, no one, not the priests, not anybody else who goes into the house of Dagon in Ashdod, nobody steps on the threshold, on the place where Dagon fell. Whenever you see Ad Hayom Hazeh Until this day, you have to remember the Gemara, I think it's in Yuma, which talks about this this concept of Adayom Hazeh, until this day, and whether it means until the Navi wrote down the Sefer, does it mean until our own day? And different cases are sometimes dealt with differently. Here, I would have assumed it's until whenever it was that Shmuel wrapped up Sefer Shmuel, but it's very unclear. We're going to come back, though, to that pasuk, because that message matters. It's not just a historical artifact. Pasuk Vav. Vatichbad Yad Hashem Ela Ashdodim Vayishimem. Apparently, Dagon falling and losing its hands is only the beginning of the crisis. Hashem's hand becomes strong on the Ashdodim, and he destroys them. Vayach Osam, and he struck them, and then the next word is written Ba'polim, but we are supposed to read it aloud as Batichorim. Neither word is a word that, you know, comes back to us easily. But that's what happens. Es Ashdod v'es Gibulea. Hashem strikes Ashdod, as well as everybody around it. Here's a really interesting point, which Ralbag floats for you. Take a look at source number 4. This is a side note, and I'm not really going to do anything with it, other than note it. Ralbag says, you remember Shmuel? Right? When last we left him, everybody knew he was an amazing Navi, and Hashem is with him, and everything he says comes true. So, and he may have told the Jews to go to war against the Plishtim. V'yidmeh she'ele ha'movsim asa Hashem yisbarach be'emtza'us Shmuel, shehaya Navi. He says, it seems like Hashem actually uses Shmuel as the Navi to perform these wonders. In other words, Shmuel goes to the Plishtim and says, now you're going to get it. And these things happen. Oh, nas is the bezulas navi lashkachasol Yisrael shalo yeyaved Aron Elokim mehem. Or alternatively, it wasn't about Shmuel at all. It was just Hashem doing this to the Plishtim in order to save the Aron. But that first idea that Shmuel is going to the Plishtim and zapping them is a fascinating image that Ralbag just puts out there. I have no medrash to support it. I know of no other commentator who says it. It's just sort of there. So I decided that I should at least point it out. But the Plishtim are struck with these Tichorim. We're going to come back to what those are shortly. But first I just want to show you what they decide to do in response to these Tichorim. Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk Ches. Vayir'u Anshei Ashdod Kichen. The Plishtim see that this is so. V'amru, and they said, Lo yeshev aron elokei Yisrael imanu. We don't want the aron here. Ki kashasaya do aleinu v'al dagon Eloheinu. They said, you know, the aron is hurting us. God is zapping us. God is even zapping our God, Dagon. Get it out of here. V'yishlechu v'yasfu es kol sarnei Plishtim aleihem. So they call a council of Plishti leaders. Vayomru, and they said, Mana sela Aron Elokei Yisrael. What should we do to the Aron of the God of Israel? Vayomru, Gas Yisov Aron Elokei Yisrael. And the answer was, take it to Gas. Right? This feels like the old Life cereal commercial. Right? Give it to Mikey, he'll eat anything. So, yeah, give it to Gas. Let Gas take care of the Aron. That's good. The Vayasevu Asaron Elokei Yisrael, and that's what they did. They sent the Aron to the city of Gas. Of course, Gas is not going to do any better. But let's pause at this stage. First of all, in terms of why they would think it would be any better in Gat, and then from there in Ekron. So I brought you the Malbim, who picks up on an odd verb. Did you notice the verb that was used in the very end there of Pasuk Ches for sending the Aron? Vayasebu. Anyone here using a translation can tell me what your translation has for Vayasebu?
They moved.
They moved? Oh, you should use a different translation. Which translation is that?
Safari.
So that's JPS. I don't like it. I like JPS often, but not on that one. Anybody have a different translation for Vayasebu? Byron, you're muted. Still muted.
I have a better translation. Well, that they took turns. So they took turns.
Right, made it a rotation. It's an interesting idea. So, if you take a look at source number 3, I'll show you what Malbim does. The Malbim takes Vayasebu to mean they sent it far away. Hasranim talua davar b'mikre. The leaders of the Plishtim assume this is just a coincidence. How you could say it's a coincidence, two nights in a row, that Dagon collapses and then the people are struck with whatever Tchorim are. That's what they said. V'akein amru she'yisov l'gat. They said, send it to Gat. L'ra'osim yishlach mateyu gam shama. Let's see if the Aron is going to do anything to the people of Gas. V'lo shalchuhu le'ir krovala ashdod, rak l'gas shahaya rachok, k'moshe kasuv yasev. They didn't send it to a nearby city. They sent it to Gat, which is far away. How do I know Gat is far away? From that term, Yaseb, Yasav. And he gives you a reference from Shmos. Vayaseb Elokim es Ha'am. When Hashem decided not to send the Jews out of Egypt directly into Israel through the land of the Plishtim, it says he sent them around, so it means going on some kind of circuitous route. They thought it's an epidemic. So if we send him to the next town over, whatever plague is here can be there also, and that'll mess up the experiment. So we're sending it to people who are far away to see whether this is contagion or whether this is something else. You follow? Where I think you can support the idea that Malbim is presenting here of Vayasev as being to send it far away, is when you look at the boundaries of Israel, as described at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, in I think it's in Matos, but it might be in Maaseh, the term that is used to describe the turns of the boundary are Vinasav. And there's some discussion there about it indicating something circuitous or also roundabout, more distant. So maybe that also supports what Malbim is saying here. So the idea is they send it to Gat thinking that this could just be in, you know, happenstance, and send it far enough away and then we won't be vulnerable. But the big question you have to ask is the question of what God is doing to the Plishtim. Why is he doing this to the Plishtim? And why does he do it in the way that he does? So, the Plishtim, keep in mind, they're Hashem's agents. Right? Hashem wanted the Jews to go to war, we said, against the Plishtim. And the Jews take out the Aron, and they lose the Aron, and it's all part of the demolition of the house of Eli. So, and the Mishkan along the way. So, what exactly, is this a punishment? Did they do something wrong? So, Ralbag, we just saw. He says, no, that's not what this is. It was to save the Aron. Right? You saw it in source number 4. Shelo yovad Aron ha'elokim mayhem. That they shouldn't lose the Aron. So this way, we get the Aron back. And this is, in fact, one view in the Medrash Shmuel, which says that they did nothing wrong. Take a look at source number 5. This is an important medrash because it captures two different positions to explain what the Plishtim were doing when they put the Aron with Dagon, going back to Chuck's point about Eitzel. In number 5, Uplishtim lakhu es Aron, etc. Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. A debate of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan amar kibduhu. Rabbi Yochanan says they honored the Aron. Amru zeloka. Vizeloka. They said, this is God, and this is God. Yavo eloka, v'yishrei tzal eloka. So, you know, put God next to God. That's what they thought they were doing. That's Rabbi Yochanan. And that's consistent with the idea that this isn't about punishing them at all. It's just about making sure we get the Aron back. Send the Aron back and you'll be good. That's Rabbi Yochanan. However, the dominant approach is that, in fact, the Plishtim did something wrong, and this is an attempt to act against the Plishtim and their god Dagon, and that's where you see the second half of that medrash, where Reish Lakish says, "Kach haya bischaran." He says, this was their reward? That's what you would do to them? If they honored the Aron, you'd give them these tchorim? That can't be. Ela amru zenotseach vizenatsuach. They said, Dagon won, the God of the Jews lost, Yavo Natsuach v'yisabed linotseach. Let the defeated one come and serve the one who won. So the Aron in this position, Chuck, is not Eitzel in the sense of being side by side and on the same platform. Rather, it must have been in some kind of service position to denote that they lost. That would be the other approach. Yes, Chuck.
The Mayan Mephorshim put the focus on Claudius' role as opposed to Plishtim.
Yes. Yep. Yes, we are getting to that. It'll take us a little while, but yes, the Jews are not the target immediately of this message because the Jews may not even be aware of what's going on at this stage. However, this will come back to the Jews ultimately, as you'll see. The idea of taking the Aron as sort of a trophy of victory is actually really popular in Tanakh. Everybody did it. Jews did it and non-Jews did it. There's a perplexing passage in Parshas Vayishlach when the Jews, after Shimon and Levi and Shechem, right? We know Dina was raped. Shimon and Levi did their whatever it was to trick the people of the town and make them vulnerable. Then they raid the town, they massacre everybody, and they take loot via Vayavozu Ha'ir. And Yaakov criticizes them. And then we're told that they buried the spoils under a tree by Shechem. But take a look at source number 6, because there's something there that sometimes people miss. Vayomer Yaakov el beiso ve'el kol asher imo. Yaakov said to his family and everybody with him, Hasiru es Elohei hanechar asher besochechem, ve'hitaharu v'achlifu simlo sechem. Get rid of the Elohei HaNechar, the foreign gods that are in your midst. Why in the world did we have foreign gods? What are we doing with foreign gods? Answer, it was considered an act of victory to take the deity of the defeated party with you as a trophy. And lest you say to me, that's not what was going on. How do we know Jews really did that? I'll give you an example from later in Tanakh. Take a look at source number 7, please. This is after a war with Ammon. Source number 7. Vayesov David es kol ha'am. David gathered the nation. Vayelech Rabasa. He went to Rabat, the capital of Ammon. Vayilachem ba. He fought it. Vayilkidan. He conquered it. Vayikach es ateres malkam me'al rosho. And he took the crown of Malkam, or Malcolm, from his head, and it weighed a kikar of gold, and it had a gem, and it went on David's head. Vatihi al rosh David. And lest you say Malkam means the crown of their king, it does not. As Rashi notes, Malkam, or Malcolm, was the name for Tovas b'nei Ammon, for the idol of Ammon. It was a name like Molech. So, according to this, David takes spoils from Ammon, including the crown of their Avodah Zarah. Chuck, you were there, I think, when we learned in the Gemara in the Avodah Zarah Shir. They asked the question of how David could take the crown and wear it. Isn't it a tool of Avodah Zarah and therefore no good? And the Gemara's answer was that he had a non-Jew who was with him be mevatel the Avodah Zarah, cancel the Avodah Zarah before converting to Judaism. So that was how he was able to take the trophy and use it. But you see that Jews did this taking of spoils, and non-Jews did the taking of spoils. Source number 8 is a very important historical document. It's the Mesha Stili from the 9th century before the Common Era, and it documents from the Moab side their perspective on their battles with the Jews. And there, Mesha, the king of Moab, says, and from there I took the vessels of God, and I brought them before Chemosh, Chemosh being his god. So Moab takes our vessels and puts them in front of Chemosh, and then The really good example of this is what comes next on your sheet, and there are various psukim about this. I actually brought them. I brought them, and then I took off some of them just because of the of space considerations. But if you take a look at source number 9, I brought you one example of it, in which when Nebuchadnezzar arrives to loot the Beis HaMikdash, he specifically takes all the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash and he puts them with the vessels of his Avodah Zarah. That's what I was bringing you in source number 9. It's attested further later in Malachim and then in Daniel. And Belshazzar uses the vessels to demonstrate victory over the Jews. He drinks from them at his party. And the Medrash has Achashverosh doing the same thing, although there are historical problems with that. But then eventually Cyrus sends them back to us. And then you may know the Gemara in Gittin, which has Titus take them away. This was a standard thing. You took the tools of worship of the conquered people, and it demonstrated your victory. Clear? Okay. So God is responding to that. Now, the first step in the response is what he does to Dagon, right? Cutting off the hands of Dagon. What's the message of cutting off the hands of Dagon? By the way, not just the hands, the head also. What's the message of cutting off the hands and the head of Dagon? Sorry, what, Moish?
No, I don't know.
Oh.
The hands, it becomes useless, but the head is a little too much.
So, it could just be general mutilation of the Avodah Zarah, right? It's just generally like, we're ruining the Avodah Zarah. It's too bad Rafal is in here. His wife, when I did this parak with the women's shear, suggested that the hands and the head represent thought and action, right? Think tefillin, shal yad, shal rosh. So it's removing thought and action, which I think is a nice idea. But also, I would go further with it. I brought you a pasuk in Yeshaya, and Yeshaya does a lot of this, and you see it in Tehillim as well, in which Hashem says, I am not like Avodah Zarah, like the idols that people worship, because I can do things, and the idols have no power. The idols are not able to do anything. Right? Think of the pasuk like, Pe lahem velo yidaberu, and I am lahem velo yiru. Psukim like that. So, the idea is that the idol is powerless. No hands, no senses, it has nothing. So that's the first message, is don't confuse me for your Avodah Zarah. But then you get to the Tchorim, and that's where things get very interesting, or a little gross, or both. Language. What exactly are techorim? So first of all, where does this appear? Where does this word appear in Chumash? The Tochacha, right? It's at source number 11 in Parshas Kisavo, where Hashem says that He's going to strike the Jews if they betray the Bris. Again, it says in the Hebrew in the letters Uva Apolim, and in the pronunciation we pronounce it Uva Techorim. So Hashem is going to strike the Jews with it. So what is it? What exactly are these techorim? So again, those with a translation, I'm pretty sure I know what you have, but tell me, what do you have in the translation?
Hemorrhoids.
Right. So that's a classic translation, is to say hemorrhoids on it, and that's Radak. If you jump to number 13, we'll come back to number 12. Radak says, Vaksiv, the way the word is written, apolim, hushem kinoi letachtonios, is a euphemism for bowels. Ki apoli, lashon givohos. The word apoli, ayin pelamid, is used in various places in Tanakh to refer to a height. An example would be in Nehemiah when it describes like the turrets on the walls around Yerushalayim. I believe that word is used there, the Ophel. So the Apoli is a term for heights, and it's a euphemism for something which is actually low, the bowels. Vakri, and the way the word is pronounced, Tchorim Hushem Acholi, that's actually what the illness is. That's Radak. The Rashi has a different view from a Medrash. I brought you the Medrash here in source number 12, and this is pretty gross. I hope everybody, you know, had dinner long enough ago. The Medrash here in number 12. Oy lanu miyatzilenu miyad ha'elokim ha'adirim ha'ela. When originally the Aron was brought out, the Plishtim said, who can save us from this powerful God? Ad kan amru tzadikim. That's what the righteous Plishtim said. Avol rishoyim amru, elehem ha'elokim ha'makim es mitzrayim b'chol makab ba'midbar. Amru eser makos hayulo ve'viyam ala mitzriyim shuvein lo maka ata. This Medrash, the first part of the Medrash, is trying to understand how it is that the Plishtim fought back if they were so afraid of God. And so it reads the part where they said, this is the God who brought plagues on Egypt, as saying, yeah, but he wore himself out. He did everything he could do. So now we can fight him. So Amr Lam Amakum, God says to them, Atem Omrim Sheili Maka Me'ata. You think I got nothing left. Maka Avi Aleichem Shloni Yasa Me'olam. I'm going to bring a Maka on you that no one's ever seen before. Vaya Echad Me'em Yoshev Batchor Va'achbar Yotzei Me'natahom. Vishomet es b'nei me'av v'chozer litahom. Person would sit down in a latrine, and along comes a rodent, and it bites him and draws out his bowels, and then it goes back. V'cheinu omer v'tichbad yad Hashem ala ashdodim. Hashem's hand was heavy on the ashdodim. The whole use of the word heavy here has other elements which are interesting, but I'm skipping that right now. It's a fascinating idea. It's certainly a fascinating idea. Radak points out that there's a reason to say this beyond just, hey, let's be gross. If you take a look in chapter 6, sentence 4, you find that when they send back the Aron, they send it with a gift. You see what they sent? 5 tchorei zahav and 5 rodents. So the Radak says, you know, that supports the idea that these were rodents. So much so that if I just take the view that these were hemorrhoids, I don't understand why they sent rodents. Right? Why did you send rodents? So in the Dot Mikra edition, they float the idea that maybe there was another plague, that rodents ravaged the land, and that was, that was also part of what was going on. Could be. I think the Medrash is also fueled a little bit by the wordiness of the text back in chapter 4, sentence 8, and the response of the Plishtim. So it could be it's about that also, but the point is this. Our text is describing something horrible, something very gross and grotesque that is befalling the Plishtim. Parenthetically, in terms of the Kriyuk Siv, the fact that it's written one way and pronounced a different way, so the written text is a euphemism so that the text that's in the Sefer won't say something disgusting. But the spoken word is the actual word. In other words, tchorim is the word for this, either hemorrhoids or the rodent, whatever the rodent is doing. And the word that's written, apolim, is to avoid saying something disgusting in the actual text of the book of Shmuel. And therefore in the Chumash, in Parshas Kisavo as well. Yes, Chuck.
Yeah, I was just saying. 28 pasuk kavzayin tuara.
Yeah.
They use the phrase afelim to describe the maka.
Right. That's what we had in source number 11. That's the That's that one. But again, that word is read, is written, but we read it as tchorim. That's exactly right. So what's the message in sending these tchorim? What exactly is God trying to get across here? I'd suggest a couple of possibilities. One possibility, obviously, is it's just really bad punishment. Like, they're going to be hurt. They're going to be punished. They took the Aron and put it in front of their God. They said that their God won. And if you look at Ralbag in source number 14, he says, yeah, it's really painful and bloody. It's something that nobody wants to experience. Abarbanel adds that also since the wound is internal, it's really hard to treat it and to cure it. Certainly true as well. But I think beyond that, there's a level of humiliation. You think you defeated God. You can't even defeat this lowly enemy. Rashi sees something like that in Yeshaya. There's a pasuk in Yeshaya which describes the gods of Bavel kneeling and stooping. Kara Bavel, Karas Nevo. So if you take a look at source number 15, Rashi there says, Elohusam shel Bavel karu karsu, lashon schok shel akumhu. He says, the gods of Bavel are described as kneeling and stooping. It's an expression that is meant to mock the Avodah Zarah. Kimisha yeshlo choli me'ayim, as though the god has intestinal trouble. Veina maspik le'sheva moshav beis hakiseh ad shu nitraz. He can't even reach the washroom. He has the runs. That's the kneeling that's described in the Gemara Megillah in source number 16, says also that it's an expression of mockery for them, specifically regarding this very base activity. And you actually have that in various places. There's a Gemara in Gittin, which I brought you on the sheet in number 17, involving a Jewish general named Bar Daroma, who was punished for his arrogance with a similar fate. You have a Gemara regarding Titus being punished for his arrogance, although that's a little bit different. But you could look at this as being about the arrogance that they displayed. It's not just, let's punish the Plishtim because they did a bad thing. It's, let's bring them low. There's an arrogance that has to be eliminated. Abarbanel notes the arrogance idea. He actually goes in a very interesting direction, which, you know, it's a little awkward. But he suggests that the idea is that this happens to the Plishti males, and they experience bleeding parallel to the bleeding of menstruation. So it's meant to feminize them, which, take it for what it's worth. He also notes the pasuk that I brought you in source number 18, which speaks of what Hashem did to the Plishtim. And it says, Vayach tsarav achor, he struck his enemies back or behind. Cherpas olam nasan lamo, he gave them eternal shame. So it's, you know, that idea of humiliation, which, by the way, parallels what happened in Egypt. In Egypt, God starts by hitting their god, the Nile, and then he strikes them. So what we're seeing here at this stage are two things. Number one, punishment for the Plishtim, like how dare you do this to the Aron? And number two, humiliation. But I'd like to float a third idea. And take it or leave it, it's my own idea. But I think there's something to be said for it. When do we first encounter the Plishtim in the Chumash? Long before that.
Grar
and Avraham, correct. Avraham goes to Grar. What happens when Avraham and Sarah are in Gerar? Sarah is taken by Abimelech, right? Round two of the let's pretend she's my sister thing, right? Because it worked really well the first time. Abimelech takes Sarah. What happens to Abimelech to keep him away from Sarah? Nope. Paro got leprosy, we think. Nigaim Gedolim, right? So take a look at source number 19, which makes clear what happened to Avimelech and his household. After Sarah is restored, Avram davens for Avimelech. Vayispalel Avraham el ha'elokim, Avram davens to God. Vayirpo elokim etz Avimelech v'yas ishto v'yam hosa v'yeledu. Hashem heals Avimelech, his wife, and the women in the house, the maids in the house, and they give birth. Ki atzor atzar Hashem be'ad kol rechem leveis Avimelech. Hashem had stopped up every womb in the house of Avimelech. So right now it just sounds like wombs are stopped up. However, take a look at source number 20. I took away the English translation so it could fit on the sheet with 21, but nonetheless. Ki atzor atzar Hashem. The text says that God stopped up the wombs, but it says atzar twice. Amar Rabbi Elazar, shtei atziros halalu lama. Rabbi Elazar says, why the double language? Achas be'ish shechva zera, shtayim be'isha shechva zera v'leida. So the first answer is that both deal with reproduction, and it's the male and the female being affected. And then they give you a brisa, which says no, that actually it's for the man, it's both in terms of procreation and in terms of being able to use the washroom. And then Ravina is even further with it. The point is that by the time the Gemara is done, the males aren't able to use the washroom, and the females are able to use the washroom, in addition to not having children. Where do you see that hinted at in number 19, besides the double atzor atzar? There's another clue. There are two more clues, really, but one is very clear. Well, that just tells me about birth. What else? Did you notice who got hit? Avimelech.
Yeah.
Avimelech doesn't have a rechem, right? If Avimelech is struck, it must be that there's something that affects males as well. So that's the explicit hint. I would add one other implicit point, which is, I can't think there were that many women in Avimelech's household who were due to give birth that day, such that you would notice that they had been struck with a plague. You know, suddenly they were all in labor and they couldn't give birth. Like, what exactly are we saying here? So that supports the Gemara's take that it's not just about producing children, but it's even about the ability to excrete. And now I come back to my point that I'm trying to get across. Maybe this whole thing is just punishment. You did that to the Aron, you're getting zapped for that. Maybe the way to look at it is it's humiliation to say, I'm going to bring them low and show them that their God is not powerful, Hashem is powerful. But I think there's a third element here, which is to remind the Plishtim of what happened the first time round. You messed with Avraham way back when, and maybe there's an expectation that there's a legend among them to remember that centuries ago they did this and they got in trouble for it, and you should know that God is still here. Or maybe it's a message for us to know that that God is still here. That's what I see in this story. I think it's not coincidence that you see the return of that problem.
See, I like the last proposition that you put forward more than any of the others. I think it fits in with a whole bunch of things. I think it fits in with Shimshon. Why did God bring Shimshon at the time to the Plishtim? To remind the Jews that one day there will be a Yeshua for them. Why did he, in the same way that God attacked them in different areas to show the Jews that their gods were subservient, God. So do here, God did it with Dagon and inspired the Jews to remember that one time there will be a full Yeshua from the Plishtim.
From the Plishtim. Yeah.
From the Plishtim.
Yeah. I think so. I think there's a lot to be said for this. Okay. So I had one more note on this, but it actually goes really well as the start for the rest of the Perek. So I think what we'll do is pause here. The note that is remaining is, I want to go back to what God did to Dagon and why that is important. And it's going to matter a great deal, I think, for what happens going forward in the rest of this perek and then in perek vav. So what we'll do is we'll pause here, and then, God willing, Tuesday, October 5th, after Sukkot, we will we'll resume. Okay?
I have one question that's a little off topic, but
okay.
In the Tochacha, there's another Korean ksiv, which is Yishkovena, Yishkovena.
Yes.
But there it's the opposite. You're reading the nicer one, and the ksiv is, I think,
So that's not so clear. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah talks about the word shegel, unlike daf dalet or so, and has some very derogatory things at first in the word shegel, and then it rewrites it and says, but shegel might be positive, because there are numerous uses of the word shegel, and some of them are more clearly positive, or seem to be more clearly positive. If I take the negative reads, if I take the positive reads, then I think it's consistent, right? Because it's written as shegel. I mean, I'm not entirely happy either, because there is, if you look in the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Chaf Hey, there is a possibility to read what's written as the negative and what's pronounced as the positive. It's not so glad. It's not so clear cut. I think what I'm saying is right on that regard, but there are things you have to contend with, for sure. Okay, then thank you very much. I wish you a Gemar Chasima Tova. And after Sukkot, we'll see what time sunset is, and that'll determine whether we're 7:30 or 8. It's getting earlier, obviously, but the clock won't have changed yet. So we'll see, and I'll send out the email. We'll be either 7:30 or 8 o'clock. Okay, thanks very much. Gemar Chasima Tova.
Yeah,
you too.